chapter 4, and try to keep your eye on the eunuch Hathach. We'll solve the mystery of his disappearance, hopefully. All right, chapter 4.
When Mordecai learned that all had been done, Mordecai tore his clothes and put on sackcloth and ashes and went through the city, wailing with a loud and bitter cry. He went up to the entrance of the king's gate, for no one might enter the king's gate clothed with sackcloth. In every province, wherever the king's command and his decree came, there was a great mourning among the Jews, with fasting and weeping and lamenting, and most of them lay in sackcloth and ashes. When Esther's maids and her eunuchs came and told her, the queen was deeply distressed. She sent garments to clothe Mordecai so that he might take off his sackcloth, but he would not accept them. Then Esther called for
Hathach,
one of the king's
eunuchs,
who had been appointed to attend her, and ordered him to go to Mordecai to learn what was happening and why. Hathach went out to Mordecai in the open square of the city in front of the king's gate, and Mordecai told him all that had happened to him and the exact sum of money that Haman had promised to pay into the king's treasuries for the destruction of the Jews. Mordecai also gave him a copy of the written decree issued in Susa for their destruction, that he might show it to Esther, explain it to her, and charge her to go to the king to make supplication to him and entreat him for her people. Hathach went and told Esther what Mordecai had said. Then Esther spoke to Hathach and gave him a message for Mordecai, saying, all the king's servants and all the people of the king's provinces know that if any man or woman goes to the king inside the inner court without being called, there is but one law. All alike are to be put to death. Only if the king holds out the golden scepter to someone may that person live. I myself have not been called to come in to the king for 30 days. When they told Mordecai what Esther had said, Mordecai told them to reply to Esther, do not think that the king's palace you will escape any more than all the other Jews. For if you keep silence at such a time as this, relief and deliverance will rise for the Jews from another quarter, but you and your father's family will perish. Who knows? Perhaps you have come to royal dignity for just such a time as this. Then Esther said in reply to Mordecai, go gather all the Jews to be found in Susa and hold a fast on my behalf, and neither eat nor drink for 3 days, night or day. I and my maids will also fast as you do. After that, I will go to the king, though it is against the law, and if I perish, I perish. Mordecai then went away and did everything as Esther had ordered him.
Thank you. So how long did you keep track of Hathach? He disappeared. Mm-hmm. Esther calls for him in verse 5. Hathach goes out in verse 6 to Mordecai. Verse 9, Hathach went and told Esther what Mordecai had said. Then Esther spoke to Hathach and gave him a message. And when you get to verse 12, they told Mordecai what Esther had said. And Mordecai told them to reply to Esther. Then, what's really interesting, verse 15, then Esther said in reply to Mordecai, and now there's just no mention of an intermediary.
How'd they get together?
Yeah, exactly. The case of the disappearing eunuch.
Yeah.
So this is the sort of thing, I've referred to Midrash a couple of times, which is it's a rabbinical method of interpreting scripture that basically takes the literal sense very seriously, but not in the way that when you hear Christians talking about the literal sense of scripture, it's kind of a very different thing. But still dealing with the exact words, I mean, as they're appearing in Hebrew and saying, why this word, why did it happen this way? So one explanation for this Hathach's disappearance. So Esther's engaging lots of eunuchs and different messengers. She starts with Hathach, but then Haman, the enemy of the Jews, notices him, so he has him killed. And that's how he disappears halfway through the chapter, which is possible. It could also be, a couple of scholars have argued, that this is a literary conceit. Just letting Hathach slide off stage here does, I mean, sort of exactly what Sarah suggested. How did they get together? It brings them together. I mean, you sort of eliminate the middleman who's going between them. You can still read it and understand that somebody's going back and forth from the city square to the city gate, wherever Esther is. But when you sort of eliminate them from the stage, it is like Mordecai and Esther are actually having a direct conversation, which is interesting, because this is very much a turning point in the text. And that turning point comes about because people start working together in sort of unity. So that's the case of the disappearing eunuch. We don't really know what happened to him. Maybe he kept doing his job, but the author of the biblical text let him slide out of importance for one reason or another. And we get the famous words. If you sort of know just a bit of Esther, this is probably the bit you know. If you keep silence at such a time as this, relief and deliverance will rise for the Jews from another quarter, which is one of those sort of oblique references. Like, well, maybe that's where God is in this text, since his name doesn't necessarily appear. Maybe that other quarter is a way of referring to God. That you and your father's family will perish, and who knows? Perhaps you have come to royal dignity for just such a time as this. It's hard not to be galvanized by those words. Esther can't stand them. She is galvanized. She is moved. It's a good pep talk. That's all. And what it reminds me of is Paul in Galatians 4 saying, for when the fullness of time had come, that just such a time as this is just weighty enough to refer to the time that Esther is in, that it's sort of that Paul sort of echoes talking about the fullness of time. And I would suggest that that's actually our first appearance of a Christ figure in this story, because she does come at the perfect time. And she is uniquely placed in as much as she shares the nature of the people who are suffering, the people who are despairing under the burden of, you know, in this case, just being a race Haman doesn't like, but we could say under the burden of sin. But she also shares the nature of being able to be a mediator with the king, because she herself is royalty. So
gave her a foot in the door.
Gave her a foot in the door, exactly, kind of like Christ had one, understanding him to be the Son of God. One of the people that we read in my church history class is Anselm of Canterbury, who liked to say that, you know, and he wrote a book called Why God Became Man, or Why the God-Man, Cur Deus Homo. And his argument was, well, we needed that because only humankind owed a debt to God. But humankind couldn't pay the debt. God himself didn't owe the debt, but only God could pay the debt. And so therefore we get the God-Man, Christ Jesus, those two natures. And Esther seems to occupy two natures in that way, being both Jewish and royal and perfectly placed. So she is, I see in her at least, a Christ figure in this narrative. So take that, Luther. Useless book. And then we go on, we get her response. One, she wants to hold a fast. And this, I mean, again, sort of like the other quarter thing, this is sort of an oblique reference to God.
Why would you fast?
If there's no divine to propitiate, if there's no divine favor to beg, why would you do that? Fasting, have you done it? It's not fun. It's it's worth doing.
Doesn't mention a colonoscopy or anything.
After that, I will go to the king, though it is against the law, and if I perish, I perish. That's the hero shot right there. If I perish, I perish. I say an echo. This came much later, but I actually hear Huck Finn. If you know that book, if you know Huckleberry Finn by Mark Twain, he makes that climactic decision that he's going to help Jim. He's going to help the slave Jim, even though everybody's telling him that helping a slave, well, not telling him, I mean, he's not really interacting with people at that point, but he knows, because he's been raised right in America, that helping an escaped slave would be wrong. And he just sort of, you know, metaphorically puts his foot down and he says, well then, I'll go to hell. And he decides to help Jim. If I perish, I perish. And it may actually be an echo of a text that did come earlier. We've talked a little bit about how this narrative echoes the Joseph narrative. And part of that story, of course, Joseph gains power in Egypt and his brothers don't recognize him and they buy food from him because there's famine, so they're out of luck. And he says, well, don't come back. You know, I kind of suspect you guys to be spies. Don't come back unless you can bring this little brother that you told me about, Benjamin, who didn't come with them the first time. And they know that their dad, they know that Jacob isn't going to want to let go of Benjamin, so they put off going back for a long time. And when they finally run out of food and there's no other option, they say, okay, well, look, we can go back, but this is what happened the first time, and he said, don't show your faces again unless you've got your little brother. And so Jacob reluctantly acquiesces to this. He agrees. And he says, if I am bereaved, I am bereaved. He does that sort of repetition, same sort of structure to the phrase. If I am bereaved, I am bereaved. And now we have Esther saying, and if I perish, I perish. Brave lady. And then Mordecai then went away and did everything as Esther had ordered him. She just took over the story. Esther, who has been, you know, the sort of obedient model, you know, as opposed to this, you know, uppity Vashti or whatever her issue was, we don't know. And I like to be sympathetic to her. No, I'm not. Don't come when you whistle. But, you know, Esther has always been obedient. She was raised by Mordecai. She accepted all the advice of the eunuchs who were advising her. Pleased the king without going into detail about how. And now she's giving orders really effectively. So she's really undergone a transformation here, and she's taken over the narrative. So what is she going to do?
Can I ask one question?
Yeah, sure.
About the fasting and knowing that it happened right when Passover was supposed to be happening? Is there any connection there, or is that like that's throwing a wrench in the normalcy, or what's the deal with that?
Right. No, that's a great question, which I haven't thought of, so I'm going to ramble a bit.
Okay.
But that's good. I mean, rambling is a good answer. You can get a lot in. So we noticed just looking in chapter 3 yesterday that this edict was published the 13th day of Nisan, which is the day before the Passover festival is supposed to start. And the observance of Passover means on the 14th, you start for 7 days, so until the 21st, eating only, I don't know if it's only unleavened bread, but certainly unleavened bread as opposed to leavened bread, which I suppose, I mean, it's not specifically described as a fast, but it seems like, yeah, kind of fast. I mean, now they're not eating anything, neither eat nor drink for 3 days.
Kind of affirming their traditions a little bit, though.
Could be, yeah. That's a great, great point. But it is, I mean, so it is interesting that there's no mention of Passover directly, but if you know your calendar, that's where they are. So when they're supposed to be observing and remembering in some particular ways a particular event, she's calling them to observe and remember, well, not necessarily remember, but yeah, fast and pray really intensely for a future thing. It's, you know, ultimately, what is it doing here? Is a really good question that I don't fully know the answer to.
I would just add that, like, a fast in the Jewish tradition is, in addition to being this sort of respect for God and, you know, giving up, you know, the sacrifice you will make, what, how small it is, it's also just like a solidarity thing, which I think goes along with the Passover tradition, but not necessarily directly linked to it, but just the solidarity of the Jews to all be going through this sort of like mild suffering together and like, you know, respecting one another to sort of uphold this promise. Kind of seems relevant here.
Yeah. No,
as far
absolutely.
As Esther kind of like bringing her people together.
Right.
In a way.
Right. I love that observation. Thank you. And well, I like it better than, I mean, I've got some friends in the past, but they just kind of do it as individuals. So I like the, I like that highlight that you've given
solidarity.
Us. This is a community solidarity thing. Esther's got a very important role to play, but she's not going it alone, except in the climactic bit. I mean, she understands herself to be coming out of this strong thing. I keep seeing a movement over here, so yes.
So what both of them have just said, Stephanie, I'm sorry.
Laura.
So are you moving towards saying Esther is a messianic image of a character?
I think she is a bit.
Okay.
Yeah.
So in a ritual act, whether it be meal or fasting, that what she's pronouncing when we think of the Last Supper, he is viewed in a new way.
Mm-hmm.
Christ is viewed in a new way through that ritual act.
Mm-hmm.
And so by their doing this together, is she viewed or recognized in a different way?
It's a part of her transformation.
That is a very interesting question. I mean, ultimately, this book resolves in a new feast. But it's not, I mean, when we talk about the Last Supper, we talk about, yes, exactly, Christ sort of reinterpreting the elements of the Passover feast in the Last Supper and saying, you know, rather than this meaning this one thing, now we have, this is my body. So yes, he transforms it in a way. And despite the sort of coincidence of Esther doing this particular action during Passover, you know, when we sort of get the explanation at the end of the book of, so here's our outcome, it's a new feast that doesn't seem to replace Passover. It takes place in a different part of the calendar, and it's just a new thing altogether, the Purim festival.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a really interesting way to think about it. If she's messianic, then does she transform the tradition that she comes out of? I mean, ultimately, I don't think Esther does for us quite as much as Christ does. I would get in so much trouble at my school if I made that claim. I do think she does sort of serve as, I mean, allegorically, in the way even just reading something like C.S. Lewis' Till We Have Faces or the Lord of the Rings stories can sort of give you a vocabulary to think about Christian truths, because the authors who were composing those certainly have them in mind.
I think
yes.
What strikes me is the sense of expectation. I mean, certainly of Esther, it reminds me less of, you know, the Passover meal and more of the, okay, put your traveling clothes on, you know, because it's this, you know, from the original Passover story of, okay, you know.
Yeah,
the unleavened bread is sort of a fast.
Like,
it's, you know, eat simply, put your traveling clothes on, be ready.
Yeah.
And it also just, I mean, I was really struck by, I've never noticed verse 12 before, that piece about verse 14. If you keep silence, relief and deliverance will come some other way. You know, I mean, there's that statement of, you know, he doesn't name God, but he just does sort of say, relief and deliverance will come.
Right, right.
Maybe you get to be part of it, maybe not, but, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Rest assured.
Which is, I mean,
expectation is really striking.
I like it with that image that I was drawing on earlier of improvisation, like, you know, you can jump in here or not. You know, there's no set script that says, and now enter this person stage left. You know, I know somebody else is going to take care of it if you don't, we hope.
Sounds like a model for Holden Village, actually. You know, that we can all work together and you know, but if tomorrow, for whatever reason, I leave, somebody else will step up and finish what I'm doing. It's not about me.
Great.
It's about a community, and that's what this place really brings home to me, is that, you know, you can do all the things that you're going to do, but it's not on me, it's on this community, and if I step aside, somebody else will step in.
We are going to miss you, though.
I will not do the electrical work.
You might.
I don't know. Yeah, well, we'd be dead.
No, but there.
Yeah,
it'll come from another quarter. I don't know where, but it'll come.
Something will come.
Yeah. And that is like a big place where faith in God is like very present in the story, even though you know, God isn't mentioned.
Exactly.
And explains to the fasting and you know.
Right.
Right.
I'm having a difficulty with that, with this presentation.
Okay.
It feels, you know, maybe I missed something and my daughter in old age fell asleep or something, but it feels like we're forcing something into the Book of Esther that, because I don't think you're saying the Book of Esther was written in anticipation.
Right. Well, that's a really good question. I mean, somebody like Luther will actually say that when David writes a particular song mentioning the king, he is looking forward to Christ. I mean, Luther understood that the faithful Jews within the Old Testament could actually, like, they understood God's full plan. They understood that Christ was coming, and in this particular way. I mean, not in the sense that the Jews understood there would be a Messiah, and then they didn't recognize Christ for what he was because they were expecting something else. He sort of understood that of Jews as well. But the faithful Jews within the Old Testament, they saw everything coming. And so Luther kind of represents that end of the spectrum. And then there's a strong tendency to draw back on the part of lots of Christian theologians. I mean, I draw back a little bit from what Luther would have said about, you know, oh, the author completely knew what they were gesturing towards and really were gesturing towards it. I mean, when I say that I see Christ in Esther, in the narrative, I don't mean to say that whoever wrote Esther, we really don't have a good idea of who or when. We can make some educated guesses. I don't necessarily think that human author had the full revelation within themselves of Christ and the rest of God's plan. Although I would be happy and not terribly shocked, I hope, to find out that that was indeed the case. But if we understand that the story that begins in creation and continues through Israel and culminates in Christ is always the same story, that God sort of always operates in the world in this way, in
anticipation of a Savior.
Yeah, yeah. Then sorts of foreshadowing are possible. And so it's a really interesting question that is sort of not my circus, not my monkey, you know, what the particular human author actually saw, or, you know, how Esther might have understood herself and her place in the Jewish tradition. I don't go as far as Luther, and, well, he wouldn't have said it about Esther anyway, he hated this book, but I wouldn't go so far as to say that, yeah, everybody totally knew what was going on, everybody totally knew that Esther was modeling this. But I think the echoes are there to be discerned, however faintly. But I more just think they're cool, and I don't want to necessarily impose a structure on the text that isn't there. Even when I say that Ahasuerus sort of is a Christ figure, like, you can only push that so far because he's a big goon in the rest of the text. The point of reading allegorically, I find it parallel to the sort of point of reading any sort of literature or poetry, because in 1,000 lines of epic text, you might see truth really briefly in one, and then it's gone and it's fleeting. I mean, I think those glimpses are there to be discerned in Scripture. And that's the way I read. You were going to help me, aren't you?
I don't know. But isn't that sort of what Paul does with Adam and Christ? When you read backwards, you can read typologically, and mm-hmm. you can see parallels. And certainly, I know I've done this, I suspect others have too, all of the suffering servant poems from Isaiah. We read Christ into those. Mm-hmm. No one tells us that, mm-hmm. but that's how we see things in the rearview mirror, so to speak.
Yeah.
Or typologically.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, then
it would help if God was mentioned in Esther.
Right.
For those who have eyes to see.
I just feel like if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance for the Jews will arise from another place. Like, what other place is he talking about if not just faith in God? I mean, maybe I'm just completely misreading that and like isolating it in a way, but mm-hmm. I don't know. To me, it's like, and I'm not even talking about Christ. I'm just talking about the Jewish God. And, you know,
sure. Yeah.
I've speculated at times that if Jesus had refused, there would have been someone else.
Hmm.
And maybe there were others that had the opportunity.
Hmm.
Or more importantly, if Mary had refused.
What if? That's a long one.
You know, forget it. Don't let it be to me according to the word.
Joseph, tell him it was you.
Oh. All right. Well, let's try to get halfway through chapter 5, and then we're all the way to where I anticipated getting yesterday. But I like it better when there's conversation, for sure. Let me get out of the way. But let's see what Esther is going to do, given this charge that she's accepted. And actually, in many ways, the church has read Esther and Mary together a lot more so than reading Esther and Christ together. I think there's a neat parallel there to be picked up. But the idea of Esther saying yes in that way, the way Mary said, let it be to me according to your will. So let's see what she's going to do. Chapter 5, verses 1 through 8.
On the third day, Esther put on her royal robes and stood in the inner court of the king's palace, opposite the king's hall. The king was sitting on his royal throne inside the palace, opposite the entrance to the palace. As soon as the king saw Queen Esther standing in the court, she won his favor, and he held out to her the golden scepter that was in his hand. Then Esther approached and touched the top of the scepter.
Anybody else blushing?
The king said to her, "What is it, Queen Esther? What is your request? It shall be given you even to the half of my kingdom." Then Esther said, "If it pleases the king, let the king and Haman come today to a banquet that I have prepared for the king." Then the king said, "Bring Haman quickly so that we may do as Esther desires." So the king and Haman came to the banquet that Esther had prepared. While they were drinking wine, the king said to Esther, "What is your petition? It shall be granted you. And what is your request? Even to the half of my kingdom it shall be fulfilled." Then Esther said, "This is my petition and request. If I have won the king's favor, and if it pleases the king to grant my petition and fulfill my request, let the king and Haman come tomorrow to the banquet that I will prepare for them, and then I will do as the king has said."
So is that two banquets?
delay, building that suspense. What is it you want? Just tell me. Oh, I want you to come to a banquet.
And are Jews being killed this whole time while they're
No.
That's a good question.
So I mean, the lot was cast.
Not the day yet.
Right. It was in the first month.
Okay.
that this sort of action, I mean, Haman makes his fateful decision to attack Mordecai's people.
It's not there yet.
Right. We're still in Nisan. We're still actually in Passover. She's fasted halfway through Passover, and now she's having feasts. But it's still in Passover, because her first request is, you know, come today, and then come tomorrow. So they're still in that festal week of Passover, which is a great time for a Jew to be making a request. Very auspicious. But they're still in the first month of the year. And when they cast the lots before Haman, the day that was selected was in the 12th month. So it's months down the road. I mean, the Jews are obviously upset. We've heard references to ashes and sackcloth. And Mordecai is quivering in his boots and encouraging Esther to do something. But we're still in month one of the year. So we've got a good bit of time before any of this actually takes effect. But that's a good question. We don't want banquets happening while people are being slaughtered outside the city walls or anything like that. So we're still in this epic week of the Passover observance. Esther's fasted halfway through it. I mean, if we just sort of understand all of the action happening immediately, which it seems to, on the third day she put on her royal robes and then said, come today to a banquet, come tomorrow to another one. And she is being very wily.
So is that just another way to curry more favor, basically?
Yeah, I mean, like the language, I think that's fair. Yeah, the language she's using is, you know, well, if I have won the king's favor, if it pleases the king, I mean, she's sort of being her... Supplicating self. Yeah,
but also maybe to like ensure his favor, you know, because she's about to take a huge risk to say,
right,
grant me my life and kill this other man you trust.
Right.
So even before she gets there, you know.
But according to verse 6, it's really just a cocktail party. It's not a banquet.
Ah,
there. They're just drinking wine. She's getting them liquored up.
Right. Which went really well last time. We'll see.
Why, if he has a hangover tomorrow?
Yeah.
Well, in fact,
he doesn't he'll drink often. I think he's fine.
Well, but he makes some really weird. You know, he decreed people be killed when he's been drunk too.
Yeah, we've seen him make bad decisions before. We don't want this to backfire. That's for sure. But yeah, last time the queen or the king made a great decision concerning somebody who had offended him, it was while his heart was merry with wine. But we'll see if Esther can retain control. Okay, we do. We have a couple of minutes. Let's go ahead and finish out chapter 5 and see how this works. So starting at verse 9, take us through to verse 14.
Haman went out that day happy and in good spirits, but when Haman saw Mordecai in the king's gate, he observed that he neither rose nor trembled before him, and he was infuriated with Mordecai. Nevertheless, Haman restrained himself and went home. Then he sent and called for his friends and his wife Zeresh, and Haman recounted to them the splendor of his riches, the number of his sons, all the promotions with which the king had honored him, and how he had advanced him above all the officials and the ministers of the king. Haman added, even Queen Esther let no one but myself come with the king to the banquet that she prepared. Tomorrow I am also invited by her together with the king. Yet all this does me no good so long as I see the Jew Mordecai sitting at the king's gate. Then his wife Zeresh and all his friends said to him, let a gallows 50 cubits high be made, and in the morning tell the king to have Mordecai hanged on it. Then go with the king to the banquet in good spirits. This advice pleased Haman, and he had the gallows made. That always cheers me up to build a big old gallows.
Seriously.
Yes.
I love the interaction. He calls his wife and his children and all his friends together and says, remember how great I am? This is how great I am. He recounts all of his honors. And I got invited to a party.
Just thinking.
And it was just me. Me and the king and queen.
I'm in touch with
BFFs.
That king.
Yeah, exactly. So we just like him more and more as the story goes on.
Can we hiss again?
What's that?
Can we start hissing again?
Yeah, actually, we do. Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. Whenever his name comes up, we obliterate the memory of Amalek from all memory. The thing about a gallows, this is going to be important later, because this gallows does get built and it doesn't go away. It's not actually, it is, you know, some sort of frame for hanging or impalement or whatever, but it's not usually a method of execution. It's rather a method of, much more cheerful. It's a method of displaying a dead body, just to sort of bring shame on a person. So that's sort of the plan that Haman and his wife have in mind for Mordecai. And we'll part with another really cheerful thing, another midrash, as far as, you know, just a sort of meditation on why did Zeresh come up with this? Why a gallows? Was that just popular in Persia at the time? Did we see those hanging around? And, you know, the neighborhood has one, and I've been wanting one for a long time.
I want mine bigger than his.
I want mine bigger. Yeah. You know, is it that, or is it... and so the midrash I came across that is just very cheerful. Zeresh is thinking that this is the old, we need to come up with something that a Jew has not historically escaped. They've proved to be very resilient and wily. They escape from dungeons all the time. Joseph certainly did, got out, if not like actually escaped. They got out of all sorts of stuff.
Lions, dens, fiery fires, and
fiery furnaces. Haircuts, and having one's eyes gouged out, that doesn't always work. Sanity still prevails. So there's lots of things. You know, they wandering in the wilderness, they got out of that. So there's lots of things that the Jews have sort of proven themselves to escape from. And so what she settles on is being hanged on a tree thing. Nobody's ever escaped from that. In fact, there's a very particular curse that goes along with being hanged on a tree. So let's do that, because I bet he won't escape.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
That's good. Yeah.
And she's the one that comes up with that.
She comes up with that. Yeah.
Aren't there other women in history that have advised their husbands in this? Is it Lady Macbeth?
Yeah. Well,
and then
or
John the Baptist.
Yeah.
Oh, good.
Oh, sure. Yeah. His wife and daughter. Who, interestingly, I do not know what to do with this. But Herod makes that generous gesture that Ahasuerus has made in our text, even up to half my kingdom. I don't quite like seeing that as a parallel, because I can't figure out what to do with it, since he's offered it to Esther. Versus a young woman who's going to ask for John the Baptist instead. But maybe that's just how you say, you know, whatever you like, up to half my kingdom. Maybe that's just the phrase that you use.
It also will be a great symbol of power to intimidate people.
Mm. Which, the offer of...
The gallows.
Oh, the gallows, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Especially if it's 50 feet high, you can see that from all from a lot of sources.
He wants people to fear and tremble. That's certainly a way to make an example out of somebody.
Yeah, right. And that's what started this whole thing. Is the king has ordered for whatever reason that people are to bow to him on anyway, and here's this person who won't. So this is what we're going to do to him. And then, you know, if people were thinking about following his example and not bowing before, well, they're going to think twice.
He really liked what his wife suggested. It pleased
it
him.
It pleased him.
So, I mean, he was just lapping it up, you know, in a lot of ways. You know,
right there.
So I think it was a vain thing, too.
And what? Haman vain? Where do you get that in the text?
She just fed it. I mean, she was good.
Yeah. Gotta know your man.
All right, well, that's our cliffhanger for today. Let's ask the king about having a gallows made, and let's see how this goes tomorrow. And do come tomorrow if you're free, because chapter 6 is the funniest chapter in the whole Bible, I think. There's a great comedic reversal that happens in our next chapter in Esther. But good, thank you for thinking with me about this.